To understand any message, we must consider it in context. When you take an isolated instance out of context, you almost always make a fool of yourself. Listening to SRN's news during this last break, you want to scream as to how no one seems to be able to view any of their actions in context. Here's even Boehner screaming that the solution to Iraq is to provide them with more weapons. And here's the National Security Advisor of the United States saying, we're not responsible. When the problem was too many weapons, and we are responsible. Well, the practice of citing isolated comments to make a point is often misleading, usually misleading, almost always invalid. It is how the church justifies religious doctrines which are wholly contrary to the Torah. And they get by with their sleight of hand because most Christians are unwilling to compare clerical pontifications to the statements from God himself, which oppose them. They're even unwilling to check to see if the context of the discussion from which these snippets were removed and altered, did that change their intended meaning? Ironically, since Paul deployed this tactic with reckless abandon, subconsciously Christians may now believe that the strategy is appropriate. According to Yahweh, and therefore Yahusha, there is nothing man can say or do that has the authority to alter or negate, to replace or to abolish any aspect of his Torah foundation, of his Torah teaching, and most especially its provisions regarding God's nature, his relationship with us, and his subsequent plan of salvation. So any proposition to the contrary is contrary to God. Therefore, the Christian myth that grace has replaced the Torah, according to God, is invalid. Similarly, the Christian belief that they live under a New Testament based upon a new covenant, both of which replace the Old Testament and its previously existing covenant, is completely torn asunder by Yahusha's instructions on the Mount. God's testimony and his covenant were not replaced. They cannot be altered. They cannot be annulled. What was is. What is will be. First among many reasons behind the Christian confusion regarding the relationship between the Torah and covenant is derived in Paul's letters, and most especially his notion that there are two covenants, with a new one already established. This polarization was based upon an outright lie, with Paul claiming that the Torah's covenant was made with Hagar, not with Sarah, and thus was enslaving. While we have only reviewed four arguments in succession from Galatians, it would not be presumptuous to conclude that these citations intend to begin a debate between observing the Torah and faith. Even from the most favorable vantage point, the best that could be said of Paul is that his words infer that men and women cannot work their way to God. But if that is what he wanted to infer, there would have been no reason to misappropriate and misquote the Torah or to demean it. To be saved, at least according to the Torah, we must first come to know Yahweh. It's the way things really ought to be. Why would you want to be involved in a relationship? Why would anyone want to have a relationship with you if you don't even bother to get to know each other? You know, irrespective of the nature of the terms and conditions of the relationship, the contribution and benefit that each party is providing. Beyond that, if you don't come to know and like the individual with whom you're having the relationship, there is no reason to engage. That's why this whole notion of Christian salvation, believe in the gospel of grace and you are saved, is so absurd. that after you're saved and then you're going to get to know God? As opposed to deciding whether or not you like him before you decide to engage in a relationship with him. You know, that would be sort of like everybody drawing a lottery number, and the matching lottery numbers were mated up. It didn't matter if it was male or female, young or old. It doesn't matter what the proclivities were. You just pick a number, somebody else pick a number, you get together, and then you can decide that after you're hitched as to whether or not you're going to form a relationship. That's the Christian position. It is back asswards. So, it is silly to think that it should be the other way around. So to be saved, you first have to be part of the covenant. And to be part of the covenant, you first have to come to know Yahweh and decide that you like him. You know, God's not forcing the covenant on you. If you don't like him, you don't need to participate. You ought not participate. But come to know him first. And if you like him, then come to know the conditions and the benefits of the covenant. If you agree to them, then engage. But if you don't like the terms and conditions of the covenant, then don't engage. If you don't like the idea of walking away from your religion, of disassociating from politics, of giving up on the false notion that your military is providing your freedom, if you want to continue to be patriotic, then continue to be patriotic. Just don't pretend that you have a relationship with God, or that God knows you, or that he hears your prayers, that he gives a hoot about you, because he doesn't. But you can love your country to death. Have at it. You can go salute when they play the national anthem. Your option. Just don't pretend you have a relationship with God when you do. Don't be singing God Bless America. It's repulsive. Don't think that you're going to church and that's a house of God, because it isn't. Don't think for a moment that a single religious person is in heaven, because they aren't. I don't care what you choose. Just don't be hypocritical about it. Don't pretend that God is as you have perceived him, because he isn't. Yahweh's provisions, the benefits of the covenant, is what provides salvation. And while it's simple enough, since there are many, we are now many days away from knowing for certain that Paul intended to convey something wholly contrary to Yahweh's message, which is come to know me first, come to understand the covenant, and then choose to engage. And as your father, if you choose to engage, I will take care of you, which includes, among many things, salvation, as you explore the Torah. Then, if you want to participate, then take God at his word. If you don't, then go off and believe Paul. That's your option. But you can't have both. So it's important that we recognize, first of all, that these two presentations are going to be wholly contrary to one another. And that we realize that two things that say the opposite cannot both be true. If God is telling the truth, Paul is lying. If God is lying, so is Paul. There is no possibility that Paul can be telling the truth, because he claims to be inspired by the God that he claims lied. Second, the Christian perspective of God and his plan are backwards, just as I've shared with you a moment before. They're upside down. It is from the end rather than from the beginning. It is salvation before relationship. It's relationship before knowing. It's action before understanding. But to properly appreciate a set of plans and the home built by those plans, you have to start with a firm foundation. You don't start with the roof. You know, the first thing you begin if you're going to build a house isn't the door. The Torah is the beginning, and it is the foundation. And if you try to build a house apart from its foundation, it isn't going to stand. You know, revelation may be the cupola set upon the roof of his tabernacle. Third, Christians confuse observing the Torah with Judaism, as if these things were related, but they're not. Religious Jews manage their lives in accordance with the Talmud, which is based upon their oral traditions. The Talmud is written very similar to Paul's letters, and that the Talmud is comprised of rabbinic arguments which seek to twist the Torah in order to elevate man's opinions above God's. The Talmud and Paul's letters are really similar, folks. Argumentative, irrational, condescending. The religion of Judaism, therefore, is in conflict with the Torah, which is why it was exposed and condemned by Yahusha. You know, Yahusha begins his message in the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of Matanyah, Matthew, by espousing the enduring benefit of the Torah. And he concludes it, moving now into the 23rd chapters of Matanyah, by condemning the rabbis and condemning their Talmud, condemning their oral law. These, if you were an informed and rational individual, you would recognize that God isn't going to defend and uplift the Torah on one hand and then condemn those who follow the Torah on the other hand. And so it's amazing that Christians have been so universally beguiled into thinking that being Torah observant is being Jewish, that being Torah observant is part of Judaism, when in fact Yahusha clearly elevated the enduring importance of the Torah in his first statement, and then at the end of his mission, he denounces the rabbinic Jews. Think it through, folks. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. If I tell a Christian that I'm Torah observant, they will almost universally assume that I have converted to Judaism. They will almost always say, "Are you Jewish?" If I tell a Christian I'm observing Passover, they will assume that I'm Jewish, that I'm have decided to participate in the Jewish religion. You think about the kind of indoctrination that's required for them to make such a moronic statement. And it is moronic, because the religion claims to be based on this fellow whose testimony we're considering. It claims to be based on Yahusha. And we only have really one biographical, historic account of Yahusha's words and deeds. At least it's an eyewitness account. Because Yahochanan, while it has a few statements about his words and deeds during his life, almost all of Yahochanan is private discussions that Yahusha had with his disciples after his completion of Pesach, Matzah, and Makkonim. And so you look at Mark. Mark wasn't around. There was no disciple named Mark. He didn't witness any of this stuff. There was most certainly no disciple named Luke. He didn't witness any of it either. So all you really got is Matthew, Matanyah, Yahweh's gift. And when you read it, you have the bookends. You have Yahusha telling us that the only means of salvation, the only means of life, the narrow gate to his home is found in the Torah. And that you can't, should never think for a moment that he came to annul it. And he in fact said, if you are without the Torah, he doesn't know you and doesn't want anything to do with you. Go away. That's how he begins. And he concludes by devastating the rabbinic establishment. And not just demeaning and criticizing and exposing and condemning their Jewish religious establishment, but condemning them based upon their law. And so if you've got Yahusha exposing the benefit and the enduring purpose of the Torah as he begins his testimony and then condemning the Jewish religious leadership for their religion and their Talmud, their oral law, at the conclusion, why would anybody in their right mind that was even remotely informed and rational jump to the conclusion that someone who is Torah observant is being Jewish, that they're being, they're, have decided to be, to engage in Judaism? It's absolutely ignorant. It's absolutely irrational. And particularly when you realize how clear Yahusha was in extolling one and condemning the other. That's why I constantly say it is impossible to be an informed and rational Christian. Impossible. If you're informed and you are rational, you can't be a Christian. There are 1,000 reasons why reason and evidence undermine the religion. The religion of Judaism is in conflict with the Torah, which is why it was exposed and condemned by Yahusha. Rabbis who have no scriptural authority or legitimacy don't understand that observing the Torah doesn't mean to do it, but instead to closely examine and carefully consider it. There are some things that we must do if we want to have a relationship with God. You know, this Christian notion, particularly with Protestants, it doesn't exist in Orthodox or Catholic Christianity where you have to go to Mass, you have to participate in the Eucharist, you have to pledge your allegiance to the Catholic Church, you need to be baptized by the Catholic Church. There's a gazillion things you have to do in Catholicism, in addition to a confession under Catholicism. There's a gazillion things that you have to do in Catholicism to earn the right to go to heaven. But in evangelical Christianity, they won't let a person do anything. It all has to be a gift. But the fact of the matter is, there are things that you do have to do if you're going to be part of God's family. And if you're not part of God's family, you can't be saved. And that is because no relationship is worth anything unless both parties contribute. So there are 5 things that we must do if we want to participate in the relationship. And preceding all of that, we can't participate in a relationship unless we understand what it's all about. And that requires observance. There are very few things that I could share with you that are more important than this. That the Torah is not a set of laws to be followed. Most certainly not a set of laws to be obeyed. The Torah is instead a set of instructions, some guidance from our Heavenly Father as to how we can come to know who He is so that we can come to know what He's offering by way of a covenant relationship. And so that once we come to know who He is and understand what He is offering, what the covenant is all about, that we could choose to participate. But it goes beyond just instructions on who God is and guidance and how to participate in the covenant and therefore to be saved. It is also a book of teaching, because ultimately that is what God enjoys. And you might say, oh my gosh, can you imagine in heaven? It's going to be this giant classroom and that God's going to get up there and we're going to have one lecture after another. He's this this great cosmic teacher, and that his idea in the Torah is to have a book named Teaching, and that's going to be fun?
Yeah.
That's his idea. And that's why, you know, it's a volunteer basis. If it's an all-volunteer family, if you don't think learning from God is fun, just don't go there. Just reject his offer. And if you find learning fun, then, you know, then find out, do you like the teacher in this case? If you don't like the teacher, don't participate. You would not only be miserable in heaven, but you'd make it miserable for us. So.
Got it.
Yes, go ahead, Glenn.
You sort of missed something about evangelicalism. You know, while the Catholics with their seven sacraments, or they say the Lutherans with their three, you know, a Lutheran or a Catholic coming away from an altar might at least have some misguided notion of having some sense of security. In evangelicalism, the easy believism is only for closing the sale up front. Mm-hmm. Once you settle in, then your status is continually called into question as to whether or not you're really, really, truly, really, and, you know, you're always treated to being dangled over a shield by a thread, you know, Jonathan Edwards, sinners in the hands of an angry God type stuff.
Yes.
You know, there really doesn't come a point where any real sense of security is conferred. There's always this, yeah, you know, you're not good enough. Are you, you know, are you sure you're not, you know, keep those cards and letters, keep people.
But that is always the problem with faith, isn't it? I mean, how does faith can't ever get to the point of conviction? So that's the problem with faith, is that you can never be sure with faith, because the moment you're sure, you don't need faith anymore. So faith is self-defeating.
Well, linguistically, I understand. In terms of philosophy of language, I'm not in complete agreement about the denotation of faith. So, but I understand what you're saying. But yeah. I have a little bit.
Yeah, it's just that.
It's a slightly different definition of that word.
Yeah, I understand that. I view the word from the intent of the religion. I'm using the word as it was intended by Paul. The reason I come to, and your point, by the way, about evangelical Christianity versus Orthodox Christianity versus Roman Catholic Christianity, is that in evangelical Christianity, the sale is made up front. And then you dangle with your goal is to constantly reinforce your faith so that you're not left completely dangling, but it is a dangling proposition with the sale up front. The reason I use faith as not knowing is because that's the way that it was used by Paul. Paul never provides any basis for knowing Yahusha. He never provides any credible basis for knowing Yahweh. He never presents the terms and conditions of the covenant. His testimony requires belief in the unknown, because he doesn't provide any information that you could come to know and understand. So it is used in the sense of it is that thing that fills the gap between when you don't know.
Well, in a way, faith is the substance of belief, the evidence of things unseen, would be the quote, New Testament quote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, unseen, unknown. I have seen Yahweh. I have seen Yahusha. I see them every time I look at the words that comprise the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms. There they are. There he is. And so I don't need to believe in that which is unseen, because Yahweh can be seen. There is a reason that he revealed his Torah and his prophets and his Psalms the way that he did. It's for him to be, for us to see him. That's why he uses the term observe, is for us to observe who he is, what he's offering, and how we can participate in a relationship together. And it's the reason that he is so insistent throughout his teaching that we go through this process of listening and observing so that we know, and then making connections, bien, the Hebrew word, bien, so it's yada, to know, bien, to make connections so that we understand. And then once we know and understand, then we're put in a position where we can ana, which is to respond. and asha, which is to act upon and engage in. And so it is it's a progression. God wants us to come to know who he is and know what he's offering, then make the connections so we think about it and we come to understand these things, and then we're in a position to respond. And you know this, so we're not disagreeing here. It's a vastly better position than hope and faith and, you know, belief in that which is unseen. Our minds are powerful tools. We can come to know and understand many things.
What I was thinking of the other week that I meant to bring up with you is that there comes a point, like in relating, like when in a love relationship, whether it's spouse, children, loving your dog, loving you, there is a point in which there, in some of the most intense relational experiences, words fail. So we have the word ineffable to allude to that. Mm-hmm. And while I'm certainly not heading in the direction of mysticism, you know, certainly, like, you know, in the afterlife, we will, you know, they have this idea that we will know him even as we are known. So I would suggest that by Ruach Kodesh, by God's spirit, through intuition and stuff, there comes a point at which words fail, and there will be an even greater knowing. there is a way of knowing and loving that is beyond words.
Yeah,
experience that in him.
Yeah, let me explain. By the way, I don't think it is beyond words, but so I will disagree with that part. But what I will say is that we will know more than we know now and understand more. And I personally think that I'm going to go out. This has always been speculation on my part, but it seems so reasonable and so consistent that I'm comfortable speculating here. We are right now in a three-dimensional world that we know for fact is four-dimensional. And we know that 96% of what we understand in the four-dimensional world is beyond our comprehension. I mean, what we know exists is beyond our comprehension. And so we're here as in a four-dimensional construct that we're stuck in one of the dimensions in just the ordinary flow of time. And we have the ability to see with our eyes, to hear with our ears, to smell with our noses, to touch with our hands. We have these senses that enable us to observe and interact with what we are able to perceive as a three-dimensional world. And for the most part, we're really on two dimensions, because last time I checked, when I jumped really high in the air, it didn't take me very long to come back right down to the ground.
Well, three dimensions, yeah.
Yeah, well, even in this three-dimensional world, we're stuck in the dimension of time, so we can't maneuver in it. And apart from a brief experience in an airplane, you know, we're really on two dimensions because we can't jump very high in the air.
Yeah.
I think in eternity, Glenn, that the universe is, I think the universe right now is seven dimensions, and that we are just unable to really grasp the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh dimensions. And that just as time is a dimension, and we just don't know how it intersects the other three dimensions to create the fourth dimension, I'm convinced that there is a fifth, sixth, and seventh. And that the fifth, sixth, and seventh dimensions, we will in eternity have the capacity to observe them, to understand them, and to maneuver in them.
Yeah, I view us as being somewhat, being like coming into a more glorified state. As God's creatures, we will always be innately limited. I mean, I believe God ups our game in our afterlife in his presence.
Yes.
I think we are increased somehow in these perceptions, but I wouldn't want it to, since it's so beyond my ken, I don't care to speculate, you know, too much about that.
Yeah, I don't care. The degree to which we will be able to understand and maneuver and enjoy the dimensions beyond time. I mean, I think time is pretty straightforward, because time, we are transformed into energy-based, and an energy-based entity, you're no longer stuck in time. Time as a dimension becomes the easiest of all to maneuver in as an energy-based entity. So I can get my mind around that. What I can't, of course, is I can't get my right mind around is the other dimensions, with exception of I fairly convinced that communication is one of the seven dimensions. It's the thing that orders matter, so that matter becomes organized energy. There's actually a communication matrix at work here. And so I do think our ability to communicate with one another and with God will be enormously enhanced.
Right.
But you know, beyond enhanced, beyond more capable, beyond therefore having more opportunity, you know, I'm going to agree with you. It's I'm at a loss to explain what it's going to be like to be maneuvering in the fifth and sixth dimension. I've got a pretty good handle on what it'll be like to maneuver in the fourth dimension and in the seventh. But in terms of the other two, I equate to dark energy and dark matter, which is one is repulsive in nature, which I've always viewed as free will, the ability to choose not to participate, and the other is attractive in nature, and therefore very much relational based. And so we know that dark energy is repulsive in nature. We know that dark matter is attractive in nature. It seems to relate well to Yahweh's nature, but if I have ever insinuated that I understand how that's going to work, I apologize, because I don't. But it's fun still to speculate. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. This is our last segment for today. We're considering the some of the many mistakes that Christians make. Beyond the fact when you say that if you're observing the Torah, that they think that you're Jewish and that you've capitulated somehow to the Jewish religion and that you've gone backwards since their New Testament has replaced the Torah, when none of those things are true. And the Torah doesn't even mean law. The Hebrew word, the root of the verb, which Torah is based, means source of teaching, instruction, and guidance. The Torah is filled with word pictures of Yahweh's nature and his purpose, his teaching, his guidance. We come to know him and understand what he's offering through the Torah. It is a portrait of Yah's covenant. It serves to convey his plan of salvation. That's the seventh step that we take from our world to his. The Torah's every story, it's every example, represents facets of a marvelous jewel. The jewel is the covenant. And he provides a perspective from which to observe, to enjoy, to benefit from not only Yah's brilliant light, but his covenant relationship. The Torah is overwhelmingly metaphorical. It's symbolic, painting word pictures to help us better know our Heavenly Father and understand his plan of reconciliation so that we can choose to rely on his provision. In this light, it is better to understand the relevance of Passover and unyeasted bread and to capitalize upon the gift than it is to do what is delineated on the right date. Understanding leads to trust. Trust leads to reliance. Reliance leads to salvation in this case. Our works, our beliefs, our faith don't lead to any of these places, with one exception. And that is that if you view being observant of closely examining and carefully considering the Torah, prophets, and Psalms as work, then that is work that you must do. If you're going to come to know Yahweh, if you're going to engage in a relationship with him, you've got to invest the time to come to know who he is and what he's offering. And if you view thinking as work, well, that's work you have to do too, because knowledge doesn't do you any good if you don't understand. And then if you view responding to someone's offer in a relationship and actually participating in that relationship as work, well, then that's work you need to do too. I am unaware of any relationship that is worth anything unless both parties contribute. Glenn, have you ever been part of a relationship where the two parties or somebody you wanted to have a relationship with didn't give two hoots about you and didn't contribute anything to it?
I've had, I think, you know, friendships that fall apart because of that sort of phenomenon
yeah.
over time.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I'm putting in here, I seem to be doing all the giving, all the rescuing, all of the, you know, you know, like if I do all the cooking and, you won't even wash a dish, I'm kind of wondering if you really care about me.
Yeah. Yeah. I had one of my first, I don't want to say loves, but, certainly infatuations back in high school. A girl that I just thought was just the ideal girl in terms of appearance, in terms of intelligence, personality, and attitude. And I had this marvelous relationship with her in my mind. You know, we went out on a few dates. And no matter what I did, and I worked at that relationship really hard, I could never make it a relationship because she was nice. She was always pleasant. She was always fun to be with, but she didn't contribute in the relationship because she didn't want to have a relationship with me. And so, you know, it was extraordinarily frustrating for me. I'm still glad I experienced that because it gave me the opportunity to see what it's like to engage in a relationship with somebody whose view of the relationship is entirely different than was my own. And it tells you, unless both parties are involved, unless both parties are contributing, it's a real drain on the one who is engaged if the other one is not.
Well, that's why it's funny, because we even talk about people being engaged
yeah.
to be married. And
right.
Engaged, and then the mind shifts from just having fun to, hey, we have to work together. We have to plan a wedding. We have to.
Yes.
That's what. And so if during that period, you know, people don't get the idea that they have to be mutually contributing, there's something wrong, you know.
Yeah, you know, we start off with the right term. You're right. It's engaged. We're engaged to be married. We're both engaged in this relationship. And if you don't stay engaged in the relationship, then it becomes a tremendous burden, very painful. A good thing becomes a bad thing unless we're both engaged and contributing. We'll talk tomorrow.